Hey New Haveners, and welcome back to another episode of Kitchen Sink. Or, I should say, to not quite another episode of Kitchen Sink. We're actually taking a break this week, but I have a surprise for you. A new podcast through the Arts Council of Greater New Haven about theater. In this first one, I sit down with Brian Slattery and Don Brown to talk small mouth sounds at Long Wharf Theater. Kitchen Sink will be back in 2 weeks with an episode about wedding cake. Until then, happy listening. Hey, New Haveners, and welcome to a new theater podcast. We're thinking about calling it CT Theater Geeks or Nerds or something like that. We're not really sure yet. Through the Arts Council of Greater New Haven, I'm Lucy Gelman, editor at the Arts Paper and a writer there as well. I'm here with Don Brown, who is an editor and critic at the New Haven Review, and Brian Slattery, who is arts editor and reporter and critic extraordinaire, among many, many other talents. Really for both Brian Don at the New Haven Independent. And today we are gathering for our inaugural theater podcast episode to talk about small mouth sounds on now through September 24th at Long Wharf Theater. So all of us at the table have seen small mouth sounds. Don, I think you and I may have seen it on the same night, although...
I saw it on Thursday.
Okay, great.
Wednesday.
Yep, I saw it on Wednesday, September 6th. And Brian, you just
saw it.
You saw it on Wednesday, September 13th.
Yes.
So it is probably freshest in your mind.
Yeah, and I had the thing that because I wrote a preview for it, I had read the play beforehand.
Which is really interesting.
Yeah, so there's a whole other experience, which is kind of neat.
I want to get into that too at some point. But, you know, I want to kick this off by saying, what is, you know, this is kind of a funny work, but as we get into this work, it's about six students, Don, I think aptly you said, in search of a teacher, sort of in search of enlightenment. We never see the teacher, but there is an omnipresent sort of booming voice that comes through over over the students with each session with, I think, some stories that really work from a dark humor perspective. But then also the teacher is sort of exposed as doing his own soul searching and maybe finding himself a little bit fraudulent or off key at certain points too. And so my first question is, you know, where are we in this work when it begins? So kind of how are we situating ourselves in this work?
I think like one of the neat places to start is what I learned from Christine Scarfuto at Long Wharf when I was talking to her about the play is that the playwright, the idea came about because Bess Wohl, the playwright, went to a retreat like this. And she went to it not knowing that it was going to be a silent retreat. So she spent
so
like the first day going like, oh my God, I can't talk and no one's going to talk. But then she, you know, as Christine put it, like her sort of like playwriting brain kicked in and sort of realized that there's an interesting premise to people on a spiritual retreat, you know, trying to sort of communicate with each other and also like get something out of it without being able to talk to one another.
And silent retreats are kind of on, I don't think they've ever been out of fashion, but I feel like I've heard them being on the up and up, maybe as people spend more and more time with their computers, they're turning, and of course we're talking about people who have some means because these aren't cheap or free affairs or very rarely are they. But it seems like Condé Nast just ran a big piece on silent retreats that I came across when I was writing a review. And so these are maybe the, you know, the natural butt of a joke, but Brian, I've heard you say, don't be so quick to go there.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that like one of the sort of primary questions in the play is that, you know, each of the characters are there because they have some sort of crisis that they're working through. One of the things that's kind of, I don't want to give away all of this stuff, but like the play on the page is really interesting because there are these really elaborate backstories for all of the characters. And it's a lot more it's a lot more specific information, some of which is in the play, but most of it isn't.
There's an
instruction in there that says it doesn't really matter if all of this gets conveyed to the audience, but this is just for the actors to know like where their characters are coming from. So for each of them, there's this like crisis that they're all going through that they're trying to work through in some way. Like they need help. And, you know, you get the impression that they've tried lots of different things, you know, and like they've come to this retreat because like they're, in some ways they're a little bit out of options. And, you know, that impulse of making fun of sort of new age stuff is like pretty understandable. And I'm one of those people who's very quick to do that, you know, in my daily life. But on the other hand, like it feels kind of cheap, right? Like these are people who are in pain and they're looking for some sort of, they're not expecting to like have their problems solved that week. It's more like they're desperate for some sort of answer and like something that will like get them closer to just not feeling so bad all the time. You know, and like, and I don't, and you know, you say like, is it really so great to be making fun of people who are going through that sort of thing? And also like, are you so much better that you think you don't need this kind of retreat, you know, or that like, is it really so bad that people are trying to find meaning in their lives? You know, that sort of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there would be much to the play if all it was trying to do was like skewer people who want new age solutions to crisis or something.
Yeah.
I mean, but you do go in with a certain amount of, okay, what is it going to show me about, you know, a silent retreat that I'm going to learn something about like what the premise or how this thing works among people actually is, because you do have to try and imagine like, what would that be like? And it does kind of have to stage that for you. But then I think the other thing that sort of in my mind going in to see it was, okay, so this is going to be theater without dialogue or with minimal dialogue. And how is that going to work?
Right.
And what's that going to, how's that going to change your expectation as the viewer of what, you know, what you're going to get out of it, what you have to see in it? I mean, I think in my review, I, you know, because I really did feel, you know, I mean, I think this is true of all theater, but particularly with this, because you're not being distracted by, you know, the same kind of level of, I guess, identification where like, you know, this person's saying this and I know, you know, who they are or what they're saying. I'm just trying to follow their logic. You know, I'm having to try and understand, like you're saying, all that backstory that is there, but that we have to try and parse out of these characters. So it really throws you on, I think, on your resources as a viewer, maybe more, you know, than something that would be more like standard people just standing up there saying funny lines and or you know,
like I imagine you're playing detective a little bit.
You do have to play a little detective.
I mean,
I think
because I had read it already,
I wasn't doing that.
But I couldn't imagine having seen it. Right. So. Like I imagine like, oh wow, this is going to be a very like different experience and like better not to know,
because you'll be sitting there going like, okay, this is the guy that, you know, and you'll
is exactly what I was doing.
Right.
Yeah.
So we've mentioned multiple layers that I want to sort of unpack, and Brian, one of the things I want to talk about is actually the fact that you, as a critic, as someone who did write a preview for the New Haven Independent, which is on its website, www.newhavenindependent.org, and
well
Don also has a great review that's up right now on the New Haven Independent. But as someone who had read this, you're in a slightly unique position, and I'm curious if you can talk a little bit more about the elaborate backstories that are in the playbook. So this is something that actors have talked a little about in interviews. I'm blocking on the name, but an actor who's from South Boston, or an actress who plays a character from South Boston in Orange is the New Black, has talked about how she actually went and spent some time in South Boston photographing homes where maybe her character would have grown up, or talking to people to master an accent. And so when you say there's extensive backstory, what are we, I mean, is this like so-and-so was born in New York Presbyterian Hospital in 1984? And
it's not, I mean, so there's one monologue in the play where one of the characters reveals their backstory.
Exactly.
And it's like this really tangled web of, you know, of things that he's trying to sort out.
And I think we can say, I'm okay with spoilers. I think we can say, especially because it's in both Don's review for the New Haven Independent and my review for the Arts Paper, that character is Ned.
Right. So like in the play, you learn that Ned was like a, you know, he had like a rock climbing accident. He had brain damage from that, and he loses his job. And then while he's in the hospital, his wife starts sleeping with his brother, and like he, you know, it's just this giant mess of things.
Yeah, it's like cosmically bad.
Yeah, like he just has all these terrible things have happened to him, and now he's an environmental activist, and he's worried about the state of the planet, and like his like personal destruction and the planetary destruction are like intermingled in his mind, and he doesn't know how to like sort out one source of pain from the other thing, and that like that's all in his backstory, and the backstories of the other characters are like similarly detailed. Like you have the sort of blow by blow of the like various misfortunes that have gotten them there, you know, to the retreat, and you know what they're all going through. And you don't, I mean, like I said, like you don't get all of that information, but
you get enough of it. I mean, yeah, you do
see it in the way that the characters perform. Yes. And you do see it in the way that the characters are performing too.
Yeah, between the couple that comes, and then the guy who has a little picture, and then you know there's the guy who seems to be what would you call it, like the veteran, the yoga teacher guy, right?
Yes.
Who sort of seems like right. You know this is his beat.
He's
like,
got it set. He's got this.
And then
there's definitely a spectrum of the characters of like people who have done this before,
mm-hmm. Right?
You know, like the guy who is the guy with the picture of his son, like he's obviously done this before. The yoga guy has definitely done this before. And then there's like the one woman who has most definitely not done this before.
Right.
Right. Like who starts off like thinking the whole thing is pretty silly.
And breaking the rules. So rule breaking is the other big thing in this. The, you know, the question of whether to follow the rules or whether to break the rules. And the surprising thing to me when I was watching this was breaking the rules really does not have huge, huge consequences.
Right. I mean, nor should it, right? Because they're all there voluntarily.
Correct.
I mean, one of the things that's interesting about the play is that it's really cool that the playwright found a scenario where everybody being quiet even makes sense. Right, like most of the time, you know, if there was a play where people were being quiet, you'd be spending the whole time being like, why doesn't anyone talk?
Right.
Like there really aren't that many situations where people voluntarily won't talk, you know, where they'll do anything except talk. And she found one. And then like as a sort of like formal experiment, the play is like really cool on that level alone, you know, of her figuring out like how much can I communicate as a playwright and how much drama can I pull out of like people just being able to gesture to each other the whole time?
So let's talk about that, because that for me, that was something as a critic that very much worked.
Yeah.
And so the role of silence, and we'll get to the role of speech and sound in this play too, but the role of silence in this play sort of only works if you have the right cast to do it. And I thought that members of the cast handled it with extreme sort of grace and nuance and beauty, but it's also a very funny show where it needs to be, and then very poignant where it needs to be. And so, Don, I can see you sort of ready to jump on the mic, but I want to hear about how this worked for you or didn't work.
Well, yeah, no, I think the whole thing with the silence as being a way to like make you have to concentrate on them and try to figure them out worked really well. Now, what the backstories, whatever, what we were figuring out, okay, yes, it was all very dramatic, and it was all sort of everyone was a crisis victim of some kind, and so that you know maybe is a little potentially overwhelming of like what our expectations of just you know an ad hoc group of six people would be, and I also felt that the events that happened in the course of the play, that some of those plot points weren't, to me, they weren't as resonant as they might have been. Mm-hmm. They weren't things. Like, okay, the bear. All right. The whole use of this, I mean, sound effects and the whole sort of, the idea that there is some kind of dramatic threat in the environment, I can see the reasons for doing that, if only to sort of create something more than just the interaction of people.
So let's set the bear up for listeners, just so people who maybe now, haven't right. seen
I agree
this
with
show.
You to the extent that, like, I had forgotten that the bear was even in the play.
Yeah, because reading it, you probably wouldn't think much about it.
Yeah.
But it's a very real presence when it has to be.
For sure.
Or at least in their consciousness when
So let's set this up, because it's also kind of the closest you get to a concrete consequence for rule breaking. So one of the things...
Yeah, which there's a whole... Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that the teacher, who we never see, but whose voice we hear, one of the things that he says in the beginning is, please don't bring food into the cabin. So you assume that the folks who are gathered there will have meal times. They're not going to be starved during this retreat.
Right.
It's miserable enough as it is for a lot of them, but they can't bring food into the cabins. And of course, one character does bring like a whole Trader Joe's bag of food into a cabin.
But she also missed all the instructions.
All of the directions.
Yes.
Which, I mean, I'm sure something was handed out before they got there too, but you know how it is.
But I think there's also this thought, and you know, this is where we can connect with it, even though it's on a very funny level of like, oh yeah, okay, maybe they're saying there are bears, but this will never happen to me.
Well,
right.
Okay.
That sentiment that something can't happen to you, or something will not happen to you because it's happened to someone else. You know, that happens all the time. We hear people say that with car accidents. We hear people say that with natural disasters. And,
like,
and
she
so
thinks,
that,
I can have a bag of potato chips.
Right.
It's not going to kill anybody.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Right. The bear will not smell my Lay's or my animal crackers or anything like that.
The best part of that was just how noisy
I thought
the crunching was. It was a great scene because it's like, it is so dead quiet and everyone's sitting there in this theater. And of course, we've all been exposed to the people in theaters who decide they want to get their little treat out or whatever while the dialogue's going on, and you miss dialogue because of their noise. And here is like everything's dead quiet, so she can just crunch these chips and just, it's just horrible. It's so, you know, and the guy like next to her or whatever is like practically like hyperventilating over this
well,
fairly minuscule sound.
It's also they're trying so hard. You know, it's at a point when the silence, I think, is still so earnest and people are working so hard to keep it and to sort of mute themselves.
Yeah, and I think that was part of the fun of it, too, is just how they have to deal, because it is a thing, right? It's sort of like, it's almost like, you know, anything else that's like a physical regimen. It's sort of like, where are you going to break down?
Mm-hmm.
Like, can you maintain this?
Right.
And they all start with that kind of, you know, college try mentality of like, this, there's a reason for this, and we have all accepted these terms. And then you just start to see it, how it breaks down because, well, first of all, the couple, I mean, it's very hard. I would think harder to be there together with whatever your usual habits of interaction
for sure.
are. And now it's just like, you know, the wall of silence has been imposed and we're not going to communicate our normal way.
Yeah. Like a couple going to a treat like that strikes me as a little bit like what I remember, like a tour guide in a canoe thing telling me about that. Like couples think it's a great idea to get into a canoe, but then they're called divorce. They're called divorce boats
that's
for a reason.
That's good. See, that's the perfect idea.
He says that he always finds like couples either are like amazing canoe partners or they break down immediately.
Yeah, you're the person I never want to be in a boat with ever. Yes. No. And that's what that I think that a little bit, I mean, it wasn't, you know, they weren't going to, you know, capsize, but there's that feeling of like, you know, who is taking, you know, who is really into this and who's not. And because the one was sort of setting up her computer and the other one was just, I mean, like, okay, that might be an issue anyways. Like every time I talk to you, you're on your computer, but here they're not supposed to be talking and she's still on her computer. And,
yes.
You know,
and then saying like, I'm just setting up my
auto reply. Yeah. So I want to let listeners know, we're talking about Small Mouth Sounds by Beth Wohl, which is on through September 24th at Long Wharf Theater. This is the first iteration of a podcast thingy about theater through the Arts Council of Greater New Haven. I'm Lucy Gelman, the editor of the arts paper at the Arts Council of Greater New Haven, and I'm here with Brian Slattery of the New Haven Independent and Don Brown of the New Haven Review. We just mentioned a couple, and so that couple is Joan and Judy. And you know, I actually think, Don and Brian, that there's this question for Joan and Judy of whether, you know, whether they're going to be really bad at this because they have their habits or whether they know each other well enough that they'll just ease into a pattern of silence and sort of carry those habits over to nonverbal behavior. And
yeah, I mean, that's, but, and they definitely seem to be, to fall into the category of those who haven't done this before or don't have much experience of this. And yeah, I mean, it struck me as odd because, I mean, okay, like, you know, watching it, you know, what your sort of window in on this is, you know, like there's going to be one character or another who you might think, oh, I could see that being me. Mm-hmm. I'd be that person or I'd be like that. You know, I'd smuggle in my chips or whatever it is. But that couple, like, I really sort of felt like, you know, that's really this kind of, you know, like, if, why couldn't you just sit around the house and not talk? I mean, like, why did you need to come out here? Like, that right away, you know, got my curiosity. It's like, what's going on with these two that they feel like this is how they want to spend, you know, because it is kind of, I mean, it was clear that it was somewhat like a vacation in a sense, like you get away from your world.
Well, they took time off work.
You take time off, you get away, and this is what you want to do versus going, I don't know,
canoeing.
You know, and some of them I felt you kind of felt there was more, like the guy, the yoga teacher, obviously, you know, it was almost like he just has to stay in shape, right? He has to maintain this air of constant, you know, transcendence, whatever it is, you know, supposedly trying to present. Not that he was a particularly transcendent character, as it turns out.
Well, exactly. Well, and that, you know, that's one of, I think, the big takeaways from this show. But also, I want to get, maybe this is going to sound a little crunchy or existential, I don't know. But I want to get into the question of, in seeing these six characters who are in crisis, you know, in some way, Don, before we were on mic, you said there are some shows you go to and you leave and you're completely changed. And maybe this wasn't one of them. But in seeing how characters are dealing with their own problems, you know, did either of you feel like, oh, that, you know, I can't believe that she's just dealing with a breakup in so poorly a way, or I can't believe that they're dealing with this sickness in this way? Or did you find yourself sort of the empathic audience member?
Well, I have to say, when I go see plays, I'm usually there as a critic, so I don't. I'm not
there to be transported
at that level. I mean, in other words, to me, I'm sort of saying, okay, has this sort of changed my sense of like what can be done in the theater, or ways in which the same thing that always gets done can be done? And I think it did. I mean, I think it showed potential for different ways of telling stories, different ways of revealing character. And, you know, sort of, I like, in general, like the ensemble theater piece anyway, where it's like all these people are pretty much on stage most of the time, or in different
little... Six people in a room.
Mismatching kind of them at different times. And so, but that's a fairly standard thing. A lot of times they're family members, they're related, or something's going on that they're all present at. But, you know, this was a bit unusual. And I also kind of feel like, because of like this dimension that, okay, it's a retreat, it's a vacation, it's also a class, it's a learning experience, supposedly. We've all gone and taken classes where you sit there and you look around, okay, who else is taking French at 8 a.m. besides me, you know? And like that kind of thing.
I had night school economics classes.
Or whatever, right? Where you're sort of like, okay, now we're all here together. And what's your story? And I think like that level of just the way that you read the other people in the room with you, like, is really intensely focused here. And I think that's part of, like, you know, a level of reality that maybe doesn't, I mean, it does come across in theater in the sense that a character walks out and immediately you know, the costuming, you know, the general attitude and demeanor, you get a reading on this character. But then they open their mouth and they start talking and you get another reading. And in this group, you really don't get those readings until fairly late when they're kind of
taking their departures. Yeah, very late in some cases.
I mean, Ned we do get because he talks. But we kind of already knew. I mean, he was such an anxious character kind of from the start.
And the actor was very good at conveying that.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, he was he was one of the real strengths of the show. That is Ben Beckley as Ned.
I mean, does this, for you, Don, or for both of you, does this do something exciting in being a play that is in part about how we make assumptions?
Yes, but that, I mean, that's to me the conversation that almost everybody could have, or if you were teaching this course, you know, in a class, because that's the kind of thing you want the audience to have to think about. Like, okay, here's these six people. Who do you think they are? Like, what do you take from your immediate reading of them. And some of it, like, you know, if they start sobbing, as some of them do, you're like, oh, geez, they must have some real issues, you know. But it's not always that clear cut that someone is upset or has, like, real, you know, real problems that are that they're working through.
Yeah.
And we find that out at different points, you know, that are pretty well structured in the play. You know, when we need to know something, we will know something, including, you know, like, sort of the big reveal that comes late, which I kind of missed. Fortunately, my wife caught it, so I asked her, what happened then, you know? But that, you know, so yeah, it's the other kind of play that if you look away at the wrong moment, you could
miss
something.
You're going to miss some pretty crucial details.
That could be an important detail.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I actually like, I mean, as I like things that challenge me. I like things that force me to pay attention. And like the thing that I really enjoyed about this play was just that, you know, that even having read it, I thought to myself, like, I really need to, like, I can't just look away at some point and think like, oh, I wonder what I'm going to do.
What am I going to have for snack after?
Yeah, like, this isn't that sort of play. Like, you really do have to be paying attention. And you have to pay attention, like you had pointed out, Don, you have to pay attention to, like, lighting cues.
Yeah, they're really well done.
Like, they point out some, like, very important details that come and go. And if you happen to be, like, looking down at your watch, you missed it.
Well, yeah. And that's actually one question I want to ask. So this play falls at a very interesting moment, like in the real world, where we're constantly curating our personalities. Or actually, yeah. I think the two of you are actually some of the realest people I know, and the most genuine people.
It's interesting
I know.
You say that, because there are people who say that my online persona is, well, the way one of them put it is, like, you're much nicer online than you are in person.
Wow.
Which is...
That's really interesting.
I wonder who that person was.
That's, maybe we should put a disclaimer, like, don't go to a play with Brian Slattery, comma, he'll be mean to you, or something like that. Something like that. But this falls at a point where I think a lot of people, perhaps the majority of people, are curating their personas online constantly. I'm one of them. And so that comes in the form of how we present ourselves with photographs, how we present ourselves maybe in video, in performance, and then also in speech. And so what does this say about how we are presenting ourselves when words are, you know, I think not readily at our disposal?
There is a fair amount of, like there's a lot of comedy mind for, like, the things that you give away you know, that you can sort of, you know, you can mask it when you're talking, but if you're just sort of being yourself, like, you actually do give off a lot of information, whether you like it or not.
And right.
And I think, you know, in terms of theater, I mean, I think there's a lot of training that comes with how do you perform someone when you don't have a script to be that someone. Like, how do you just turn into this person behaviorally? And I think that, you know, is something that's, you know, really a part of, like, the artistic effect of this, is that, you know, these people are all very good at conveying someone who isn't them, right? They aren't really this person.
Right.
But they can inhabit this space and this role. I mean, I said something to Brenda Pelluggi, who plays Alicia in the play, because there's a part at the end when they're all kind of, like, burning their mantras or whatever it is as a sign that the session is over. And it really went through my head while I was watching them do it, that it was sort of like, okay, you know, these characters are all going to leave this, you know, retreat and go back to their lives. But all these actors are also just, you know, these characters for a short period of time, even though you kind of now think of them as being those people. I mean, after you see them in the first scene, when the next scene, when they come in, we've kind of identified them all. Like, we sort of feel like, okay, that guy. Yeah, I mean, we sort of know something about them, and we've sort of taken a reading on them. But of course, they're just actors. And if you saw a different, you know, group of actors playing it, you'd have maybe a slightly different reading or a somewhat different reading of each character.
And I am always that yutz who, like, meets an actor after I've seen them on the stage. I'm like, they're completely different in person. Like, of course they are.
No, but it's, you know? It's true. I mean,
but there is something, like, pretty jarring about, like, seeing what people, like, you know, what actors are like.
Because here you could almost believe that they are just six random people. Like, I said something in the review about, like if you're sitting on a subway, right? And you look around who's on the subway with you, and, you know, you might do your readings of, okay, that person's on their way to class, that person's, you know, very, you know, high end job, you know, whatever. But
yeah,
you
do get a lot of
same kind of readings on these people, yeah. But they're, of course, they're just characters.
And we know those people. I mean, all of them sort of, you know the person who just exudes tension as soon as they meet you. And probably, you know, the person who seems like they're karmically in sync with the universe, but actually they're a hot mess. Or, you know, the person who's actually, you know, seems like they're a hot mess, but actually they've kind of got it together.
Yeah,
they just
really
need to work through some things. So one thing.
And this play is very good at that, right?
Yes.
Of like setting up the archetypes that do get you, like, those, they're very useful in the sense that they help you find your footing.
Right.
But then as soon as you've found it, you go, oh, right.
Someone's... Yeah, I think Jan or John or however he says his name, I think he was the one where there was most of a change, of a switch in how I understood that character.
I mean, I feel like he's the heart of the play to me.
Yeah, because he gets, like, the last line, which is very important.
Yes.
And
yeah.
It's kind of like, it's the big...
Right.
Like,
and I feel like his grievance is also like the most kind of pure,
mm-hmm.
like it's this like really devastating thing.
Right.
And it's like, it's obviously kind of ruining his life, and it's ruining his life in a way that nobody would judge him for. Like he's lost a son at an early age, and he just can't get past it.
You're right. I mean, I think you could say that his life is ruined, and the whole question is, can he have some other kind of life? And he's maybe trying to find his way to that, but
right,
yeah,
and he has the fewest tools at his disposal to even like articulate.
Yeah, but see, but you know? Early on, like, he seemed to me a very confident, like,
right,
I'm here to enjoy nature and to be, you know, at one with myself. Like, he seemed to be the guy that was going to be least affected by the others or whatever their
right.
issues were, because, you know, he knew why he was here, and it's not quite that way.
And he sort of has that going on, right? In the way that he's dressed, he's sort of like Mr. Mountain Man.
He looks, yeah.
Mr.
He looks
REI.
Like he's the outdoor guy.
Even when he gets eaten alive, he gets eaten alive by mosquitoes.
And he
and
finds,
sort of
he
just,
finds humor in that.
Right.
Yeah.
He finds humor in it and sort of deals with it heroically and then goes on and is just fine. But I want to, before we run out of time, Brian, how are we doing on time?
We're doing fine on time.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
Well,
also, it's a podcast.
Yeah. Yeah.
What does that mean? You just snip?
We can just go as long as we want.
And just cut out all this.
Yeah. But I do want to talk about sort of the ancillary characters that are in every play, which is set design and lighting design. And
props,
and
design,
props design is huge, and even costuming
and the projections, those sort of scenes, video projections of sort of the trees with the rain hitting them, and
right, that look like something you might have like stock photos on your MacBook or something
totally.
Like that.
Yeah.
Because I found those extremely affecting. It was sort of effective and affecting in telling the story. And situating us in this universe.
Yeah, so because otherwise it's kind of hard to believe that they're out in this remote area, because they're just kind of in what could have been a room in, you know, anywhere in, you know, Brooklyn or New York or New Haven even.
Yes.
And but we did have to
coming
feel
soon
that
to a
they
yoga
were,
studio near you.
Yes, exactly. Some storefront. I'm sure there's a storefront downtown that could use this. Yeah. So I mean that was all part of like creating something that. Yeah, and sound, I mean, we heard, well, not only the bear, right, but we heard the rain very loud, which was interesting to me because I just seen the show at Westport that had the cicadas, so, I mean, they were deafening.
And what show was that?
Appropriate, okay. Or appropriate, depending on how you want to say it. It could go either way. By Brandon Jacobs Jenkins.
Mm.
So I don't know, maybe sound is starting to become, you know, that thing.
Well,
now.
I also enjoyed the thing that the teacher who you never see, they sort of intentionally put him through like a microphone that isn't that good.
Yeah.
Like it's all overdriven and he doesn't really know how to use it. And it's like sort of,
they
like,
did a lot with him, with his
I
voice.
Thought they did a really nice job with that.
And
even
his little
the flute. And then the idea that like, they were like, you know, they would just hear the at the end, like, and they were never sure what that meant.
At one point, you really, you know, like, was that a gunshot? Did he drop the phone? Right. It was like they all looked startled, and it was startling.
Yeah, I love that idea that it's kind of like the thing ends, and they don't even know. They're like, is it over? Do we go now? And then, you know, because he never says like you know class is over or you're free to go. It's just like his microphone cuts out.
Well, and then he doesn't leave them particularly well equipped to deal with any of the crises with which they have ended up, the baggage with which they have ended up at this
right.
sort of retreat. And I think, not to give too many things away, but certainly at the end of the show, that is, if you haven't gotten it by that time, you see it when he instructs Ned to pick up a singing bowl.
Right.
And Ned has no idea what to do with it.
Now, for what it's worth, what's kind of great is like the instructions for the actor for that scene are really funny. And I sat there going like, how is he going to convey this? Like, there's a point where he has the match and the bowl. And like, one of the instructions is, it occurs to him that he might be being asked to set himself on fire. And I thought, like, oh my God, like, how would an actor possibly,
And yet he does.
Yes.
I mean,
yeah,
so
the sense of total bewilderment is
Ben
there.
Ben Beckley,
yeah.
the actor who plays Ned.
But also just the aim to please. Like, yes. The whole, you know, I want to do what is expected of me
right.
properly at
like,
this
I'm,
moment.
I'm taking this seriously.
Like, I'm taking
I'm
this
here
seriously.
To...
I don't want to disrespect this moment, right?
Right. Well, yeah. and sort of the idea that has been there throughout of, like, if I'm not following the rules, or if I'm not trying my best to follow the rules, if I'm not listening to this teacher tell his weird and quirky stories that are supposed to have a moral, why am I here?
Right. Well, he's also the one that, but in his speech, shows, I mean, I don't know whether they all have the same degree. I mean, he shows that he's truly involved with this teacher. Like, he really believes this teacher.
Wants,
he's followed him online.
Yeah.
And
he wants
something.
Yeah. Something
from him. The others, you know, how focused they are on this particular person is hard to say.
Yeah. But again, like, what the teacher says, though, gets back to what we were talking about before, that, like, you know, it's easy to sort of hear what he says and be like, well, this is silly.
Yeah.
You know, but on the other hand, you go like, do you have any better ideas?
Right.
Do you have any better ideas for, like, finding the meaning of life? Because if you have them, like, we're all ears, right?
Right. Yeah. And I found myself actually going through that, where I kind of thought, well, this is a load of bull.
Absolutely.
You know, when I was listening to the teacher, and every so often you see, like, in the little, you know, ticker tape that's on the bottom of a TV screen, you see, like, Yogi Master, blah, 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 has been arrested for tax fraud or
right.
tax evasion.
Right. Or sex scandals.
Right, or sex scandals, or right. or something like that. And so, of course, that's at the back of my mind. But, Brian, absolutely, I had the reaction of, like, well, you know, I've also been at that point where I feel like I'm going to jump out of my skin because I'm so anxious about something. You know, and if this is the self that people seek, what's wrong with that?
Right.
Well, it's also the fact that that little ticker tape along the bottom of the screen is never going to say, Yogi Master transcends time and matter. You know, right. It's just not going to say that, right? Like, so that's not the story they're ever going to tell you, right?
I think the way that would show up in the news is manhunt for Yogi continues.
That's right. Vanished. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. So we are here. If you're just joining us, I'm Lucy Gelman, editor of the arts paper at the Arts Council of Greater New Haven. And I'm here with Dawn Brown of the New Haven Review and Brian Slattery of the New Haven Independent. We are kicking off a new podcast by talking about Bess Wohl's Small Mouth Sounds on at Long Wharf Theater through September 24th. And Brian and Dawn, I want to ask both of you about, you know, we've talked about how the role of silence in this play immediately flips it on its head, because usually in shows we hold space for silence. You know, if you think about something like Jackie Sibley's Drury's, her We Are Proud to Present, which is a very, very different show tonally. But if you think about that and sort of the long silence that comes at the end, that's earned. That's earned at the end of a rodeo, an exhausting rodeo of a play. But in this, speech is earned. And I found that some of the shows missed up. So I thought this was a very, very strong show from a young playwright. But I also felt that some of the show's missteps come from a compulsion on the part of the playwright to explain where explanation maybe isn't needed. And so I'm wondering how both of you reacted to that.
I actually wouldn't characterize the things as missteps. Like I saw it as like when they were speaking, it was most like what you learned at that point was how invested the person was in the project anymore.
Interesting.
You know, like the people who are going like, you know, I'm gonna see this thing through, like they're there to do something serious. And then as soon as somebody starts talking, what they're saying is like, I'm out. Like, I'm out of this. I don't wanna do this anymore. And like, I thought that was really effective in a lot of places. I mean, particularly like with the couple where there's something very powerful to me about the, like that one of the people in the couple starts talking and the other one doesn't. And you'd like, that's your first indication that like, this is a conflict over that is not going to get resolved. Like one of them is saying like, I'm here for keeps. Like, I want to see this thing out. And the other person's saying, I'm going to go get Starbucks, which is what she goes and does. But like, I loved and again, like going back to the thing of the formal ingenuity and finding a scenario where one person won't talk, like she found a really cool way to have a scene like that where one person is talking and the other person doesn't answer them. And it makes total sense. Well, and she was able to mine that for a lot of emotionality that if the other person could have talked, you'd say, why aren't they talking? You know?
Yeah, well, I don't know that I would say it's a misstep, but I thought that it was a little overdetermined, however you want to phrase it, about the written down mantras. Like in two separate stories, this became an issue, what the person had written down and someone else seeing what they had written. And that, to me, that just seemed, I don't know, a little flabby. Like it wasn't that, it, you know, you needed some kind of device maybe that would get us there, but that just seemed like a very like kind of easy device or in some ways, because sometimes those things to me, like they undermine your sense of this character as someone like, you're like, really? Like, you know, you leave your mantra lying around and then you get mad because somebody reads it. You know, it's like, you know, oh gee, I didn't log out of my account, you know, and you read my, you know, like, you know, whatever, you know, I left my phone there or something. I mean, these things happen, I guess, but it's sort of like a little too simple-minded to me, but like the way that, like, and so much, you know, was riding on it in a way, like that you would, like whatever your mantra was supposed to be, it was supposed to be something that was like private and kept to yourself. You wrote it down just so that you would actually have to articulate it in particular words. And I love the guy that had pages and pages.
Yes.
For his mantra.
Yeah. You can stop writing. Yeah. Please stop writing.
Yeah, please. That was great.
But Don, say a little bit more about that, because I think I also found it maybe a little too easy. But then there's also the question of like, it's such a childlike or sort of base impulse to peek.
Right.
I would like to think that I'm not alone in having done that at some point. You know, like hasn't everyone read their mom's email account that she kept open when they're a kid, or read their brother's journal?
Can't
no.
There.
No. Right. Right. Or you know, maybe looked at a friend's diary entry when they weren't supposed to. I think, you know, the idea that someone has peeked at something that is verboten, at some point in their existence, is a pretty relatable feeling. Although I could be wrong. Maybe I'm just a terrible person here.
I mean, that's all true on the sort of the realistic aspect of like how these things happen or how they work. But in terms of like the play, it means, you know, we're going to introduce, okay, the plot point that is introduced simply because it has to have a consequence, right?
Yes.
So when someone writes a hidden message on a mantra, someone has to read
it. Now there has to be
someone has a gun.
Chekhov's mantra.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a loaded mantra there, pal. And that kind of thing is a little, to me, it was a little hokey, but not in any major.
But it also seemed like,
my suspension of disbelief is over now and I have to leave. You know, I'm going to Starbucks.
But it didn't seem, it didn't seem hokey to me because it felt like that's the sort of thing I would expect to happen in a workshop like that, where you're forced to write down, like,
well, yeah,
tell
that
me
goes
why
back to class, like you said, looking at what someone else writes on their paper and all that sort of thing. Yeah. Okay.
Like the hokiness to me lay with the fact that like there are workshops out there where you would probably be made to write down like your intention of being here.
Well, and one thing in this was, I thought it was right on as far as being realistic for most of it. But did both of you get that? Brian, I'm especially interested since you've read it. And so you perhaps know as much about the characters as the actors know about themselves.
Yeah. I mean,
but the bear, you know, this bear is a little, I mean, it like anything like that, like it has to land right. And like, you know, I don't know.
The bear was one of the elements that didn't quite work for me.
But like, a lot of those things don't for me. Like, you know, to me, I'm really like, you know, character based. You know, I'll be with these people from, you know, the beginning to the end. I don't need that, you know, oh, look, you know, there's a bear.
There's enough going on.
Suddenly they hear that there's, a serial killer at large or something. Like,
I liked it better when they thought it was the bear and it wasn't. Those moments were great.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that was very funny.
That's what I sort of assumed the point of the bear was just to like create these situations.
But it did make for, I mean, okay, theatrically, it made for the great moment of the sound effects of people in the throes of sex and then a bear joining in,
which I appreciated.
Yes.
Well, and then it's also like, I found myself wondering, certainly during the scene where there's some like compelling backwoods lovemaking, but even before that, what's the place of the sounds that we make inadvertently?
Totally.
The small mouth sounds, but also call them the small mouth sounds, the diaphragm sounds, the belly sounds. Yeah,
totally. Like suddenly they're all meaningful, right? Because they're just the only things that are coming out of you.
Yeah. And I wonder how that is, particularly for like the people in the show, because, you know, from night to night, the sounds coming from the audience are going to vary greatly and widely. And it's sort of like, gee, everybody was really laughing about that the other night. Or like, you know, you hear all the creaking and crinkling and things going on.
We're getting at
a lot of that is happening to the to the characters themselves amongst each other, like, you know, whether someone snores or crunches chips or, you know, is clicking on something is right. really bothersome.
We're getting at one of the things that like I wanted to talk about with this play, especially with the two of you, is that like, you know, that sort of thing of like theater is like the thing that we're watching. Mm-hmm. You know, theater is like life, blah, blah, blah. Like, which can seem very silly sometimes if it's forced. I think
someone once said that all the world is a stage.
I know, isn't it? Where is that
from?
One
of those things, you know?
But like, you know, those that can feel very silly if you don't earn it. But like, this is one of those plays that did earn it to me. It really did sort of point out that, you know, what we're doing right now is not all that different. Like what the audience members are doing watching the play is really not all that different from what the people on the stage are doing. No, we've taken a vow of silence, we can't yell at the audience, looking at them. Right. It's a theater. People are talking to you and your job is to just sit there and like not make any noise and not make too many sounds and just sort of receive whatever it is. And then whatever's going on in you is going on in you internally, but you can't, you know, the person who turns to the person next to them and starts talking about the play, you're just like, oh my God, be quiet.
Right.
Yeah.
But there is.
So like that was fun for me because it like there were moments in the play where you felt like you were part of the play in a way that felt like really organic and earned. And it made it more interesting.
Well, there is this whole kind of school of thought of like sort of accessibility focused thought coming out right now. So the International Festival of Arts and Ideas talks about this a fair amount. So, you know, this idea that for a very long time, there's been kind of audience appropriate behavior at the theater, at the symphony. So you can't stand up and clap between movements if you're...
Which still bothers me, has always bothered me.
Right. Or if you have a case of bronchitis, maybe you should stay home, which arguably is true because you don't want to affect or infect other theater
goers. You want to be patient zero for the bronchitis.
But you know, I did hear people, one person when I attended the show in the audience did fall asleep and was snoring, which was great. But sort of a lot of like belly laughs that went on a little too long to be thought of as, oh, that's theatrically appropriate. But then also an amazing thing happened, and I've talked about this with Elizabeth Nearing, who's director of community outreach at Long Wharf Theater, the audience was breathing with the play when I saw it. So the instructor says, breathe in, breathe out, or take a deep breath.
Yeah.
And the audience breathes with the play, which is very, very interesting.
That happened when I saw it also, for sure.
So, I mean, one question I have as maybe we wind down is, you know, this work, so Longworth Theater, if I understand it correctly, is the first stop on an international tour. And so is this work done? I mean, of course, is a work ever done, Don? But is this work done, or does it still feel like maybe it needs a little tweak? You know, last year, Longworth Theater ended their season with the most beautiful room in New York, which did not feel done. It felt like a draft. And this certainly doesn't feel like a draft.
No,
but there are a couple outstanding questions, or there were for me. So, you know, are we expecting this work to change as it tours?
Well, as Steph and I were driving, Steph is my wife, as Steph and I were driving home last night, one thing we did talk about a lot was, like, you can imagine the play changing a lot because the actors have a lot of latitude to try to convey, you know, whatever it is they're trying to convey. And you definitely could see the play at the end of the tour being, like, really quite different than it is now. And that, not to say that, like, you know, it's a flawed thing that they're trying to improve. It's just that there's the actors, and there's actually, like, on the page, there's a fair amount of, like, there's almost like a conspiracy between the playwright and the actors, where the playwright is constantly saying, like, I'm giving you all this information, but you can do whatever you want with it.
Right.
And, like, you can see it for an actor being really fun.
It's really a fascinating idea of it being on tour, because it is going to be in different places, in different towns, with different expectations. And how things fall, you know, will be different in different places. But also, I think what you're saying is the degree to which they don't just, you know, burn their mantras and walk out and then go take another part, but they're going to be committed to these roles for quite some time and in a lot of different places. So I think that, you know, that to me is like, maybe that's the best way to imagine this, is like getting a cast who will have to live in these roles for a period of time, like it or not, right? And then all that backstory will really start to make sense. It'll be like, you know, okay, at this time I'm going to do something different to let people know something more about that particular character. So, whether it's done, I mean, it had a time, I think it was originally at the Araka Project, and then it got like a New York run. So I'm sure it's gone through other iterations. I mean, I sort of feel if there were things to tweak about it, maybe some of the things like that you were talking about, Brian, is sort of like the explanatoriness of some of the things could be, backed off from a little bit. It could be, you know, left more to the audience to intuit what's going on. But then again, like, that's the sort of thing where I think in different places, we think we're fairly sophisticated here in New Haven. Like, there's going to be places where, like, what? I didn't get that. What? You know, and like I said, I kind of missed the one little thing. It's easy, you know, even without like nodding off or anything like that, you kind of say, hey, wait a minute, something happened. I didn't get it. It's a good show for
you. Have a point really... there, because it even relies on a certain amount of familiarity with like New Age stuff.
Right.
Which is something that I take for granted because I grew up in this giant hippie town. But like, it occurs to me that there are people who would be like, where are they?
Yeah. Who are these people?
Like, well, it's very basic. Yeah. Like, where, what is this?
One thing that I did wonder. So I went to the show to review it, but I brought my two very Midwestern parents, and my mom is sort of crunchy, as she has become sort of like crunchy granola in her later life, and gone to Kripalu, which is a yoga center, and she's sort of familiar with silent meditation retreats, and she has a couple colleagues where she works who like do retreats and do Burning Man, and so she's hip to all that stuff. And my dad is a good-natured guy, and so he thought it was very funny, but I wondered walking out, you know, is this a regional show, or does this show sort of resonate in a regional way? Because I see it in some ways as an East Coast show, not in the same way that The Most Beautiful Room in New York was about New York, but I did see this as a show that really works. on the East Coast, Don, I think partly because like you can see these people, you know, on the subway, but you can't specifically see them like getting back in their cars and going to their corn farm in Grinnell, Iowa.
Yeah.
No, there's something to that. I mean, even to the point where when I heard what the play was about, my immediate thought was, oh, it's like the Omega Institute. And it turns out that that is where the playwright went. You know, and I was like, oh my God, it is the Omega Institute.
Wait, and can you tell listeners what the Omega Institute is?
It's a retreat center in Rhinebeck, New York. And it's, you know, it's pretty sort of high end.
Yeah, I don't remember where all it's going to, but yeah, some of the places did seem to be more of a kind of a hard sell or I don't know, more distant or, you know, from what we would expect this kind of thing to get.
But who knows?
And we don't specifically know where the characters are going back to.
Right.
After the show. We know that that the Rodney, the yoga master, we know that his wife is waiting for him out in the parking lot.
Though I think like in his defense though, I mean ultimately this show is kind of like this very cool exercise in people watching.
Yeah.
You know, it's the whole thing of the way that, well, I mean, I don't know if everybody does this. But, you know, if I'm on like a train or a bus or like, or waiting for it, it's always public transportation for whatever reason, but whatever, wherever you, like you are where there's a group of people
and
they're milling around, that's the universal aspect of
thing that makes it East Coast in a way,
but it could be like, if you're waiting, anytime you're waiting in line.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. And there's, line, you know, there's 20 people in front of you and you can, you kind of like, I get bored enough waiting in line that I end up, if I'm not talking to the person next to me in line, I sit there and I think about like what all these other people are doing.
And that's a game. You know? I mean, it's a game that people play.
Yeah, I don't think I'm alone in that. I even do that like driving around in traffic. You know, if there's a traffic jam, I'm like, well, I know why I'm driving around, but why is everybody else driving around?
Oh, totally.
You know, that kind of thing.
What is someone's backstory or what is a couple's backstory?
And this play like really taps into that. Like
absolutely.
That sense of how fun it is just to watch people when they're not necessarily interacting with each other, but they're telling you a lot about themselves.
Yeah, so I think that's probably true. Curiosity about other people is probably necessary for the audience. If you really look at people and are like, well, no, I even said that to
if you're like
to
a psycho, like, if you're a psychopath,
if you're the kind of person that sits there and you look at those people up there and you're just like,
I
don't care about any of these people. Like, none of these people are going to matter to me. Then you're not going to get much out of this. And she said when I talked to her for the preview, you know, it was just sort of like the more invested you are with the characters, the more you'll get out of it. I mean, that's probably just obviously true in most plays, but here, that investment, I think you have to get past your, you know, okay, I'm interested in what that person's saying, or I think that person's funny. Or,
you know, that's
like, you really have to kind of say, okay, I want to know what's going on with that person.
That's an interesting thing, because there are people out there who, you know, when you say, how did you like it? They'll say like, well, they didn't give me a reason to like the characters. So there are people out there that the play might not connect with.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I fully endorse this play, even with a couple of very small misgivings. We're talking about Bess Wohl's Small Mouth Sounds on at Long Wharf Theater through September 24th. Guys, do you endorse this play?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's definitely one of the more interesting theater things to do right now.
Totally. And it's the kind of thing that Long Wharf is good at.
Yeah. Like
they're particularly good really at this good, kind of thing.
It's a really good space for it and really well done technically and interesting. Provided that you yourself are interesting. If you're not interesting, you'll probably be bored.
So I feel like that's actually a really good note to leave listeners with. It's on you, listeners. Right. If you're not an interesting person, don't go to this show. We've been talking about Small Mouth Sounds at Long Wharf Theater, written by Bess Wohl and directed by Rachel Chavkin. I want to thank Don Brown of the New Haven Review and Brian Slattery, arts editor and writer and critic at the New Haven Independent. I'm Lucy Gelman, editor of the Arts Paper. And this has been our very first, podcast for the Arts Council of Greater New Haven. Thanks so much for listening, and we will catch you when the next play is in town.